You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we can do better. As Zack Snyder's notoriety has grown, the controversy around his films has as well. His most recent release, Batman vs. Superman, was maligned by critics and many audience goers, but it was also embraced by many other audience members. I, obviously, am of course in the latter group, the group that embraced it. But I will admit that it took me several viewings, and especially seeing the Ultimate Edition, to really embrace it. The first time I saw it, I have to say that I was affected by all the negativity surrounding it and Zack Snyder. I watched it very hesitantly, almost worried, as if it wasn't going to reach the levels I had seen his previous films reach. But as I watched, I began to calm down, but there was still something off. And we'll discuss that in a few minutes when we touch on the theatrical cut. Overall, I enjoyed it the first time I saw it. And then I saw it 2 days later and enjoyed it a little bit more. And I think I remember actually seeing it in theaters the third time, and I liked it even more the third time. But I was filling in the gaps. And it wasn't until I finally saw the Ultimate Edition when it was released on Amazon. I was waiting at midnight just clicking refresh until they put it in my Amazon Video, whatever it had been. I don't know if it's the word bin or not. And that... when I watched that, that's when I finally fell in love with this movie. Where does it rank amongst Snyder's other movies? We'll discuss that as well after we analyze it. Joining me this trip, via G-Chat, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, what was your experience with this film?
Saw it. Liked it for the most part in the theater, though could see the complaints about the sort of strangeness with the plot. Got to the ending, hated the ending, and came back and laughed at it all with you guys on the podcast. Saw the Ultimate Edition and thought it was much better. The editing was so much better, and we'll get into that. But still hate the ending, and thus that will be reflected in my ranking. We'll save that to the end.
Well, not the ending. You're talking about, like, there's two climaxes, basically, in the movie. You're talking about the first climax, not the second one, right?
Martha!
Right, so the first one, not the second one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the part you hated. Okay.
Yeah, he's not talking about the ending, because I think it's very hard to hate the ending.
Yeah, right.
Correct. No, I still, to this moment, think the Martha scene is dumb.
Also joining us via G-Chat from the hills of white privilege, James Elias. James, what's your experience with the film?
So, with my experience of the theatrical cut, was similar to Daniel's. What I most notice is the development of a lot of different themes that just didn't seem to be fully fleshed out. And then the Martha part, of course, bothered me a lot too. However, when I saw it the second time, it gave me a little bit more opportunity to think about what the movie was trying to say. And by the second time, I was able to fill in the gaps in the editing and kind of realize, like, oh, okay, they are developing. I can really see the themes that they're developing. And as a result, I just enjoyed the movie more the second time. I just had a stronger emotional reaction. Everything meant more to me because I actually understood it the second time. And so I'm hoping that in the director's cut, some of those gaps are filled in and we're able to have that entire experience hit us the first time. The second time, I will say, even the Martha scene, I still didn't like it, but it was less ridiculous to me the second time around because more context was available to me to understand what was going on there. And I'll get more into that later, but that's my overall picture.
Yes, that will be we will discuss the Martha scene at length. That will be a big part of the near the end of the podcast. near the end of this episode. But finally, our final panel member today, joining us via G-Chat from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. Elliot, what was your experience with this film?
Let me just go on record as saying that I'm probably the only person in the United States of America that liked the Martha scene.
No, I'm with you, Elliot. It's going to be split down the middle. I'm on your side.
I liked it because I got what he was doing. You know, sometimes you just, you know, you need a pause, and that gave him, you know, I wrote about it. I texted you, Justin, when I was waiting to actually go see it, because I think you were about to see the showing for the second time, and I was about to see it for the first time. And
yeah, you tried to get in a little mini competition. I think you saw it 6 times in theaters. You were trying to get me to see it more than you.
Yeah, it was fun. but I my initial impression of it when I saw it, I actually and I probably, you know, unlike a lot of people who saw it, you know, the theatrical cut in theaters, I actually really enjoyed it a lot. Like I said, I mean, the Martha scene didn't throw me off too much. I mean, there was definitely editing issues. And I and the comparison, I mean, when you see the Ultimate Edition, there really is no comparison. It is a superior film. But I enjoyed the theatrical cut because I enjoyed the themes. I enjoyed what the film was trying to say. And I really liked exploring the themes. And I think that they actually delve into it more in the Ultimate Cut, the themes of society's relationship to the ideal, to a hero. Because the main theme of it, the role of a man of ability, which we'll talk about, I know you have that coming up. But it's also a film about us in a lot of ways. I've always viewed it as a view of how we are, do we believe as a society and as individuals, do we believe that goodness is possible, that the heroic is possible, that the ideal is possible? And there's just so much in there that I mean, one of the reasons why I saw it so many times is I wanted to really kind of mine that theme and mine what the film was trying to say.
Yeah, and I think in what you're saying is Batman really represents the audience in that sense in the movie, and we'll delve into that when we get into discussing his character. But what you said about the difference between the theatrical cut and Ultimate Edition, I think is really important to note. When I finally sat down to watch the Ultimate Edition, I actually had a very strong emotional reaction. And the emotional reaction I had to whenever the new stuff that was added in played was I actually felt a lot of anger. And my anger was at the fact that I ever had to suffer through watching the theatrical cut, because the difference is so stark. It's like a great work of art, and you're shown a bad version of it. The main difference for me, and this is, I think, what James is referring to when he sees it the second time and likes it more, and this is my experience with liking it the third time, those gaps that we filled in ourselves are filled in the Ultimate Edition. The transitions are all back in. You understand why the scenes are put in the order they're in. Whereas in the theatrical cut, it just cuts from Superman's story to Bruce Wayne's story to Lex Luthor's story. You're like, how are these all related? But in the Ultimate Edition, all those transitions are back in, and you understand how it all flows together and fits together.
Oh, yes. And this is also why it's so superior to that other film from the competition for DC. I won't even say their name.
That's it. That's all we're going to mention. We're not even going to say it. Other differences with the theatrical cut, there's a longer African scene in the Ultimate Edition, and that makes why people are upset over what Superman did in Africa makes so much more sense. Also, there's a lot more Lex Luthor, and a lot of people's complaints about Lex Luthor's plot not really making sense and his motivation not making sense. That makes a whole lot more sense. You understand why, you get his obsession a lot more, what drives him a lot more in the Ultimate Edition. Did anyone have anything else they noticed or any other comments they want to make about the theatrical cut versus the Ultimate Edition?
What was it that people were complaining about Africa?
It's not that they were complaining about Africa, but they're just saying it doesn't make sense in the theatrical cut why the world would be mad at Superman for what happened for Africa. They don't understand why they would be blaming him for things. When in the Ultimate Edition, the scene is longer and you actually see a KGB, Lex Luthor's henchman, burn the bodies. And you understand that he's doing that to make it look like Superman used his laser vision on the Africans and on the villagers. Whereas in the theatrical cut, it looks like they just shot him and then burned it to cover up the fact that they shot him. But people are like, well, why would Superman shoot people? But it's really done to make it look like it's his laser vision. And they just that scene is built up a lot more, and you get philosophy out of the African warlord, and you can see that it's the same philosophy the African warlord has that's driving the hatred of Superman throughout the world. So there's this interesting commentary on the equivalency between American government and society and an African warlord, saying we're really not that different with the way we treat goodness.
There's actually an additional, an entire African character in the extended edition who at first, I believe, is hired to sort of testify against Superman at the hearing, and then she gains a conscience about it, but before she can testify in favor of Superman, she's murdered.
Yeah, that's so, part of Lex Luthor's plan. Lex Luthor hires her to say false things.
There's so much more detail to this, to the theatrical cut. It's almost like that the original version, or the theatrical version, is you know, it's a Robert Frost poem, but you take out all the adjectives.
You just leave the rhymes in, and you're like, these rhymes make no sense.
Like this, I mean, I sort of get the story here, but it was kind of a little Dr. Seussie without, you know, the color added to it.
Yeah. Oh, also
to it, it's like, oh, I get what he's doing now.
Right. Yeah. And also in the African scene, there's a whole drone strike. The U.S. So there's a whole controversy about Superman killing people, right, in Africa. Supposedly he kills people, so everyone's mad. But there's a deep irony here that the Senate is holding these hearings to say, why did you kill people, when the U.S. military was going to strike that village with a drone and Superman stopped them. That whole irony is missing from the movie when they take the drone strike out.
That's
which
right.
Which is actually an echo of Man of... There's a whole echo... That's an echo of Man of Steel, where he, at the end, the last scene, you know, with Christina Wren, he brings the drone down, remember?
Yeah.
And the other thing
is, he's dreamy.
Cut that. How could you cut that entire, like, subplot that gives poignancy to, you know, the theme of Superman being attacked for being good? Like, how could you, it's like, make the movie like 5 extra minutes. I think that's worth it.
Well, that's the problem with it, is you can tell they were going for the runtime of 2.5 hours, because everything they cut out was like, oh, if we cut out this 5 minutes, it won't hurt it that badly. If we cut out this 5 minutes, it won't hurt that badly. Well, if you cut 5 minutes 6 times, you've lost 30 minutes, and you've lost the cohesiveness of it.
And I just missed the investigatory part. I don't even know if that's the right word, investigative part. Sorry. But no, but the scene where Clark Kent actually goes to speak with the young woman that you see on the stand when she's delivering that testimony to June Finch, he goes to speak with her, and that's where he first learns about the Batman. And that's what prompts his investigation into who the Batman is. And you really miss that element of the two of them kind of on their own investigations, unknowingly making their way towards each other. And so because of that, you really don't get a sense of how villainous Lex Luthor really is. Because in truth, and I know you're going to touch on this later on, the battle is not really Batman versus Superman. It's really Lex versus Lois. And you really get a sense of how villainous Lex Luthor is when you realize how he has manipulated these events so that they will discover each other and so that they will come into conflict with one another.
I agree with what you're saying. I would just say it's two sides of the same coin, where Lex and Lois is the psychological, philosophical battle, and Batman and Superman is the physical battle. So you put them together and you get mind and body. And in the same sense, when you're talking about the investigation and Clark's investigation, if you take all that out, which they did in the theatrical cut, you don't get as much of a sense as to why Superman doesn't try to reason with Batman more in their fight. Because in the beginning of the fight, he starts pushing Batman around, and you're like, why are you doing that? And that really only makes sense in the Ultimate Edition, where you understand that he doesn't really believe Batman can be reasoned with.
Yeah.
You do see that theme a little bit as someone who's only seen the theatrical cut. You do see that theme a little bit in the theatrical cut, but it's only hinted at, and so it was only the second time that I saw the movie that actually made sense to me. In the first movie, it felt like, oh, well, Superman's just angry that this guy is challenging his power, and so obviously that depleted my enjoyment of the movie a little bit. But then the second time around, I was able to remember, oh, yeah, as Clark Kent, Superman has... you know, been talking about how ruthless and unscrupulous Batman is, And so by the time they're fighting, it's just like, oh yeah, I'm just dealing with some psycho who brands people. So I'm not going to try and reason with them.
Right, essentially. Especially when...
You to understand the second time I saw the theatrical.
Right, and especially when he starts, you know, that psycho starts shooting him with machine guns and traps and everything, that's when he stops trying to reason with him. Because he already thinks he's a psycho. Exactly. So let's talk a little bit, before we get into the themes and the characters, let's talk, you know, just very briefly about the cultural response to this movie. Because I think it says a lot that this movie was responded to in a certain way. And of course, the main response to this movie was that it was dark and not fun. And that's really interesting to me because I don't have that response at all. I think the movie is very fun. There are great moments of humor in it. And I find it very hopeful. I find it a continuation of the theme of Superman being a symbol of hope. And really, I think what people miss when they're saying it's not fun and it's dark is they're missing that the point is that people in the world aren't living up to that symbol of hope, that they've never seen it before. And now that they see it, this is how they grapple with it. But the point of the end of the movie is, no, now we've seen hope and we can live up to it.
We can do better.
Right. That's
right.
Right. 100%.
The dark thing, the problem I have with a dark critique of this movie is I don't know what they're actually referring to. Like, dark compared to what? Certainly, maybe dark compared to a Marvel movie, but that being said, that's not a bad thing, because I think Marvel movies lack consequence because they're so fluffy. Like, a Marvel movie is, I wouldn't describe a Marvel movie as light, I would describe it as unsubstantive. If by dark they mean complex or intricate or not immediately apparent, like who the good and bad person is, I'm sort of fine with it being quote unquote dark. But I actually don't know what the reference refers to.
Well, I think that's the question that is interesting to ask, because I think on a surface level, they're saying it's dark because the lighting is dark or it's desaturated. You know, there's this myth, this idea that Snyder's pictures have no color to them, and there's no brightness to them, which is just simply not, it's factually incorrect. But I also think that the darkness is referring to what you just said, that they think it's a dark view of humanity because it's not altruistic. I really believe that.
And there's some objectivists that have made that confusion as well, which has been really fun to try to discuss with them.
Well, I mean, look, would someone describe Schindler's List as dark? Well, I'm kind of serious, but I mean, I picked that movie on purpose because the movie is about horrible things and it's about complex situations. But Schindler is a hero of sorts in that movie, certainly someone who did something heroic, and it's supposed to be maybe a little bit hopeful at the end, but I wouldn't describe the movie as dark, whereas like a fucking, what is that Darren Aronofsky piece of shit,
Black Swan
is a dark film.
Yes,
like everything is bad, it's gross, the scenes are horrible, it's about someone being psychotic, the themes are depressing. Like, that is a dark movie, but it's about ballet. So,
yeah, and if you can make Keira Knightley, Mila Kunis sex scene dark, you've accomplished something.
Yeah.
Keira Knightley, or was it Natalie Portman?
Natalie Portman, I'm sorry. They're the same person.
Well, let me take a moment, as usual, to be the disagreeing voice here. To me, dark... I think of movies like The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rising. I think of movies, and of course, Batman Begins, too. And most of Christopher Nolan's movies, I see them as dark, even though with Christopher Nolan, you always have heroes, an uplifting theme, and sort of a hopeful cast against a dark background. And so to me, and even for me, you're going to be surprised at this, but for me, even Interstellar is dark. Entire situation because of all this. I describe Christopher Nolan's style, his sense of life as hero in an evil universe. It's that the universe is, it's got sort of a malevolent sense of life to it, where it's like the universe is dark and evil and it's out to kill you, but man can be great and man can survive it. You know, man can take it. He can overcome. So to me, these movies are dark. So I guess we should really parse out what we mean by dark.
Let me try and mediate this a little bit. And, you know, we can discuss Nolan when we get to doing Nolan's movies. I think that's true of some, but not all of his movies. In regards to Batman versus Superman and Snyder, I don't think the same thing applies. In Batman versus Superman specifically, I think there are good people and there are bad people. So I think it's a balanced universe where there are the people that are good that are on Superman's side, and then there are the people who are bad who are against him, and it's balanced. I think the movie appears dark because on a surface level, it actually appears that Lex Luthor has won, because his whole entire goal was to prove that Superman isn't all good or he isn't all powerful. And by Superman dying, he proved that Superman isn't all-powerful. So he feels like he has won, especially because he knows Darkseid and everyone from Apocalypse is coming because the bell has been rung. But Superman has actually won at the end because he is a symbol of hope. That's what, remember, his dad said to him, his Kryptonian dad, "You, Jor-El, you can be a symbol of hope for these people to aspire to be something better." And the end of the movie is Batman saying, "We can aspire to be something better." So it appears dark because it appears like it's an evil universe and it appears that Lex Luthor has won, but it's actually a balanced universe, which is what reality is. It's neither good nor bad. And Superman has actually won, even though it doesn't appear that way.
So hold on, just to be very clear. If in our use of the word dark, are we simply referring to malevolent versus benevolent universe?
That's, I think, how most people are using it.
For me, there's two aspects of, and I've written to myself at least some theoretical breakdown of how you can judge movies' sense of life or just the sense of life of any art. And there's two parts of what dark versus light means. There's the view of man depicted and the view of the universe depicted. So you can have a malevolent or a benevolent universe premise. And then separately, you can have man as a hero or man as a sniveling piece of shit. So in a movie like, you know, No Country for Old Man, you have dark. Man is a piece of shit and the universe sucks. In Nolan, I think you have malevolent universe, but man is a hero. And in Snyder, in Batman versus Superman at least, I feel like it's malevolent universe, man is a hero. But I'm willing to be convinced out of it by arguments that Justin was just making kind of right there. That's my way of breaking down the two parts of that concept of darkness.
Well, yeah. And okay. Daniel, what do you think of that?
I don't think that's a bad sort of hypothesis to work from or a bad way to look at the sense of life of a movie. It's hard to be completely objective about this because we also approach movies with our own sense of life. Not
yes.
that we can't be, but sometimes it shades it or it's something like Rand. I mean, this is the perennial example we use, but like Rand looking at a Salvador Dali painting and be able to say, "Yes, I really love the technique here, but the sense of life is gross," or you know, similarly. So I don't know. I mean, for me, I don't see a particular malevolent universe in the world that Snyder presents, but I don't know. I'm sort of the opposite of James, where it's like I could be convinced to James's position because I don't wholeheartedly hold on to my own.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that's a good open question for us to move forward for, but I think the important thing to remember is that this is a more intellectual approach to dark than the people who are saying it. And I think the cultural response to dark is referring to the lighting and the coloring and the fighting at night. And they're also, I just simply think they see lack of altruism as a malevolent universe premise. The idea that Superman needs a reason to fight to them, I think they see that as dark. That he's not just going out there and saving people because he's Superman.
Where do you see that sentiment being projected, though? That like where people are actually referencing that kind of thing as the reason they feel it's dark?
I mean, in every article that's been written about him. I mean, go to Birth, Movies, Death. Go to all the critics. They're all writing.
They're saying this isn't. This is what you were referring to earlier, where you said that this is a deconstruction of Superman, like almost a reverse Superman, like because he's egoistic in this film.
Right. We'll get to that as well when they continue the Jesus subversion in this movie. You know, the main way this is said is when they say Superman doesn't smile in the movie, which is also factually incorrect. They want him to gladly accept bearing the burden of the world.
These are the same people, I suspect, who hated Sully because he was too much of a hero.
Right, and that was the example I was going to use as well. You could argue, from James's perspective, that Sully has a malevolent universe with a good hero.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That hero in an evil universe sense of life is, according to my theory on this, my sense of life that I personally identify with. So I'm going to be more likely to see that in movies, because that's the kind of theme I'm going to latch onto, even if it's not fully there.
That's fair.
Yeah, so that's something I'll say to sort of temper my opinions on that, is I come from that sense of life perspective, so it's gonna have that tint.
Yes, and I think that's why we have a whole panel here, and we have all four of us today, because we can all have these different perspectives, which adds to the nuance of our discussion. So we appreciate you, but I appreciate you bringing that, because I think it's important to bring up with the critiques that have been levied. So for now, though, let's keep that in mind as we move forward, and let's start with a discussion of the theme. So to me, I have this thing, and I don't know if you guys have the same, I don't know, it's almost like a superpower, I want to say, in a way. When I watch a movie or read a book, I can tell what the key is, and I mean, there's always, especially in romanticism, there's always a line or a scene that is the key to understanding everything else. And when I saw Batman versus Superman the first time, it was obvious to me that the key was during the montage of news coverage, when they show him lifting the rocket and floating above the people in the flood when they're on the roof reaching up to him, and they have all the different newscasters saying things, and the different thoughts, like the Woodburn guy saying things. And the quote that to me is the theme of this movie is, "The fact is, maybe he's not some sort of devil or Jesus character. Maybe he's just a guy trying to do the right thing." And even in this quote, we have what James is referring to, where the movie portrays the devil and the Jesus. It portrays the light and the dark. You know, Gotham is the dark. Gotham is the malevolent place, is the malevolent universe. And then Metropolis and Smallville as well, that's the benevolent universe. That's the positive thing. And the whole movie is like, well, which is right? Is Batman right? Is Superman right? But the point is that it's not either of those. That's a false dichotomy. It just is. The universe just is. Man just exists. But the interesting thing to me is something we've talked about on the regular edition of the podcast is the interpersonal hostility that people approach the world with and approach each other with, this belief that there's hostility in interpersonal relationships. And I think that drives a lot of the evil characters in this movie, that they expect there to be interpersonal hostility. And that's shown by the African warlord when he's talking to Lois Lane, and he says to her, "Men with power obeying neither policy nor principle. No man is different. No one is neutral." Well, and that's exactly what I was just saying. He doesn't believe that people can be neither a devil nor a Jesus character. He believes that everyone is a devil character. And the interesting thing here is it's not just they don't just obey policy, so his idea that governments aren't going to stop people, laws aren't, but they also don't obey principle. So the idea that nobody can act in a principled manner. This, you can definitely see this. That's what largely drives evil in the world. That's why in The Dark Knight, the Joker was portrayed as an anarchist, because he was saying there's no such thing as principle, and I'm going to show you that. And I think this movie really is a meditation on all of these ideas.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, and this is why I brought up before about how it's something of a conviction on the audience. You know, because it challenges us, because just before the line that you that you quoted about the Jesus or devil figure, just before that, the same commenter says, what we do is we project our ideas onto who Superman is.
Correct.
So what I take that to mean is, it really the film asks us as the audience, do you believe that heroism is possible? Do you believe in the good? Do you believe? And because if you do, then why don't you live that consistently in your life?
And not just that, Elliot, not just that. You're 100% correct. But I want to go a step deeper on that. It also challenges your view of yourself. Because as is often said, when people speak about others, they're more often speaking about themselves. So the fact that they can't see Superman as acting principally and doing the good because he had the power means that they believe if they had the power, they wouldn't act in a good way. So they're afraid of Superman because they're afraid of how they would act if they were Superman.
Right.
Yeah, that's very good. The quote you pointed out, I think I would agree that that's the proper theme. I might have phrased it differently before this, and in fact, I wrote it down as basically something like the role of power in society and the individual. And because I think all the characters have to deal with how they check power in themselves or in the world. Lois Lane does it with the government. The senator does it with Superman. Superman does it with Lex, and Batman does it with Superman. And then Batman has to deal with it with himself as well, being the vigilante and his own power. So I don't know. That was my initial thought. I kind of like the quote thing better, but even though that's not a I don't think that's an exact formulation of the theme.
I don't think it's an exact formulation either, but I think it's easier to grasp because it's in the movie's own terms, and I think it's easier to communicate to our audience that way because they can think of it in the movie's own terms rather than thinking on a meta level and then having to take those thoughts and reapply it and retranslate it in the movie's language. I'm using the movie's language to make it easier for the audience, basically.
So what you're saying is our audience is dumb.
No, I'm saying it's very difficult to – it's like speaking foreign languages. I'm saying it's very difficult to envelop yourself in the language of a piece of art, then discuss it outside the piece of art, and then go back into the piece of art. That's what I'm saying.
Right, Tom. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. James, were you going to say something?
Yeah, so I know you've said this in your own way, Justin, but the theme – of the movie itself bears repeating, and at least to me, and you can correct me if you think I've made a misformulation here, but to me the theme is, well, at least this is a theme, is Superman is this, and it's the theme of the first movie too, Superman is this absolutely stellar individual, and how does that make you feel as an individual, and you see other people, you see all these people's reactions to this ideal man, and at first everyone's on board, but then they start realizing, wait, that means we have to live up to it. And so you find this string of rationalizations for like, well, he's not actually, you know, or maybe we're afraid, he's not actually that great, or maybe we're afraid of him now because we can't handle the idea of having to live up to this new idea. So we're either going to make him a god, you know, something that, you know, we were never supposed to live up to begin with, a demon, so we don't have to live up to him. And then of course, there's the right choices as we realize, hey, this is just a guy just like me who's just trying to do the right thing, as I should be. He just happens to be from another planet, has powers we don't have. But
yeah,
he's basically the same as me.
Right, I think you've perfectly described the psychological application of the theme to the characters. The only thing I would disagree with what you said is you said it applies to Man of Steel as well. Man of Steel is an introspective movie. Man of Steel is about Superman himself accepting that he's Superman. Now this movie is about the world accepting the fact that he's Superman. So that's why it's the sequel to Man of Steel.
One might say
that Man of Steel is the Fountainhead, and Batman vs. Superman is Atlas Shrugged.
We're going to reorder a little bit. I wanted to talk about images of this theme next, but let's talk about it since you've opened that door, Daniel. Let's talk about how this film reflects subjectivism. Why do you say that the first one's the Fountainhead and the second one's Atlas Shrugged?
I say it only broadly and sort of metaphorically, although there are some
I think there's more parallels in Batman versus Superman to Atlas Shrugged than there is to the Fountainhead and Man of Steel.
Well, what I'm saying is Man of Steel and Fountainhead is with the, you know, it's the it's about the individual, the soul of the individual, and Atlas Shrugged is about like the soul of the culture,
yes,
society. And I think in a very broad metaphorical way, that's how the two movies deal with things. Obviously, very different plots, but. There are some overlaps. I mean, we pointed out before, and we've read some quotes where Snyder has explicitly said he has an Ayn Rand aesthetic.
Yes.
And there's some evidence to suggest that he's familiar with the Romantic Manifesto.
Well, and he's making The Fountainhead. He's currently in pre-production. How long he'll be in pre-production for, we don't
Wait,
know.
What?
You didn't know that?
I knew he was thinking about it.
It's not, I mean, it is something to be excited about, James, but it is, that still does not mean it is going to be made.
Right, he just said he's developing it, which is pre-production.
Yeah. Yeah. He's working on developing
it. Well, tell him to hurry up!
We'll just call him now. And
yeah.
Tell him to hurry up. So there's evidence to suggest...
We're going to use our direct line to Snyder not to get him on this show, but to get him to make The Fountainhead faster.
Six and one. So I obviously Snyder is obsessed, I think we see with all his movies, like the ideal man or perfection or what it means to live up to an ideal. So I think those themes are similar with what objectivist art would encompass. Obviously, like the individual versus the collective, Man of Steel had that in spades. This movie has it a little more subtly, but it's definitely in there. Yeah, I mean, those are a couple things. Anything else that I'm missing, major themes?
Well, I think the interesting thing about what you're saying is Batman versus Superman actually has more of the Tui villain, and Man of Steel actually has more of a Atlas Shrugged type villain.
Hmm. Gotcha.
And I mean, if we're talking about, you know, just images and stuff. I mean, obviously we talked about a Man of Steel, how Zod's speech is pretty much how you would want to execute or how I would want to execute Galt's speech, the way he takes things over and the way it's actually shot and everything and the way it's edited between everyone seeing it. And then images in here of Atlas Shrugged, I mean, the statue of the false god statue, that's, I mean, if that's not based on Atlas, I don't know what is. That's actually my phone background right now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, come on, when he's holding up the rocket, that's Atlas as well. I mean, that has to be. That's intentional. That has to be intentional.
Well, remember the beginning with Senator Finch when she says, "Does Superman act by our will or by his own?" That is a very strong Atlas Shrugged theme. When you think about the end of Atlas Shrugged, when they have John Galt and they're torturing him to try to get him to cooperate with what they want, that's kind of what popped into my head when she said that. It very strongly evoked those images, you know, of people trying to control people of ability to get them to do what they want.
Yeah.
And then there's, of course, the line from the trailers where Martha Kent flat out tells him he doesn't owe this world a thing and he can choose to be Superman or not. I mean, if that's not objectivist, I don't know what is.
That line got so much hate, and I loved it when I saw it. I mean, it was wonderful.
And then the other thing, Daniel, something you like to talk about all the time about, you know, objectivism. Isn't, in a way, this movie just basically about hatred of the good for being the good?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of that. Lex Luthor, sort of, you know, what is his motivation? It's confusing unless you realize it is a pure hatred of the good in many ways.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's kind of incoherent, and I think that's why people were confused by it, because they don't often think of hatred of the good as being a legitimate thing. I think there has to be a reason to hate the good, which is not true. We know that for a fact. And and that was not the case with Man of Steel. It was not necessarily about hatred of the good. It was about two different sets of principles and which principles are right.
Although I think that hatred of the good kind of dances around in the that's the wrong way to put it, but it's always in the background of Man of Steel, because Papa Kent, he's he kind of knows, like, yeah, the world's not ready for you. People aren't good enough to see you as an ideal man and then react appropriately. Like, and so he says, so he, it's not explicitly stated that there's this hatred of the good, but it's like, we as the audience are supposed to somehow know, kind of like, yeah, are people even ready to see the ideal man yet? Well, how are they even going to respond?
Right, and that's ultimately his flaw, is that he gives, you know, in Atlas, Dagny says, we never had to take any of this seriously, did we? Well, Pa Kent's flaw is he takes the hatred of the good seriously and tells Superman, tells his son, you need to hide yourself. And that's ultimately why he dies. So I think you're right. I mean, I think that's part of what makes this movie so brilliant, is it so perfectly builds on that theme, that flaw that was in his dad and that was given to him. And then he has to really address that he was taught that people are going to hate him. And he has to address whether to take that seriously or not in this movie, when his dad did take it seriously.
Yeah, agreed, it's there. I think it sets up this movie more so than it is the primary theme of the other one, but it's definitely there. And I think that's smart sort of overall filmmaking on Snyder's part, is you set up subsequent themes. Just like I think the government's going to play a much bigger role in the next movie. As we talk about, you know, Finch's comment, does he act on our will or our own? And then knowing what I know about the DC universe, where one of the biggest villains in the DC universe is not some external power, but the US government, I think they're going to play a much bigger role. Like, our will versus his own will is going to be a much bigger theme in the future.
We already saw that with Amanda Waller and Suicide Squad, didn't we?
Yes.
Yes, and that's what they're doing with that as well. That, I mean, Waller, not to give up too much, but like in the overall DC universe, is like one of the biggest villains.
Yeah.
In the DC universe.
But yeah, she's established a complete piece of shit in that Suicide Squad movie. She's just capping her own people right in the head.
Yeah, because she forgot to tell them to leave the room.
Yeah.
Oops! Forgot! You're gonna die now!
I didn't even think of that. Oh my god. Ah, shit, I forgot to tell them to leave the room. I hate it when this happens. I've been training them for weeks.
She's a terrible character, like a wicked... On Arrow, she was on Arrow, and I cheered when, you know, she got shot in the head on Arrow. Oh, she's a repulsive character. Even in the cartoons, like, she's terrible.
So let's talk about one other comparison here, and then we'll talk about the images. The one other comparison I think we have to make here is to Watchmen, because we know Snyder reinterpreted Watchmen in a very objectivist way, and I think this is actually the converse ending to Watchmen. So Watchmen, Snyder's, was all about how Ozymandias turned Dr. Manhattan into the villain, and the world ends tragically. To me, Watchmen's a dark movie because of that, of how it ends. Rorschach has to die, Dr. Manhattan's the villain, and he leaves Earth. You know, his whole conflict is, am I going to leave the Earth or not, or am I going to stay here? Well, he leaves because of what Ozzy does. Whereas this movie, Lex Luthor, the Ozymandias character, tries to convince the world that Superman, the Dr. Manhattan character, is a villain. Superman has to decide whether he's going to leave or not. And ultimately, it has a different ending, where Superman decides that this is his world and he doesn't leave it. And, you know, in Watchmen, Dr. Manhattan leaves Lori. Right? He's not in love with her anymore. Well, here, Superman decides he's going to stay with Lois and that he loves Lois.
True. I didn't think explicitly about all those parallels, but it's absolutely right. And there's actually a similar theme in Watchmen, which is like how the world deals with its heroes, or not heroes, how the world deals with people with extraordinary ability. And in Watchmen, it's super skeptical and it's dark and they have to die in the end and be controlled. And I think we're supposed to see that as tragic from Snyder's point of view, which is why it is a dark movie and why it is sad. And in this movie, it's the opposite. In this movie, the world sees Superman as the hero that he was, and he is a hopeful figure.
Right, just think of it this way. At the end of the Watchmen movie, Dr. Manhattan is the bomb that blows up the cities. At the end of Batman vs. Superman, Superman is his monument. And if you seek him, look around you.
Yeah.
I love that moment. Oh. Sends chills on my spine.
So what images did you guys see in this movie that really encapsulated the scene and the theme? And I'm going to start with one because I noticed something on my rewatch, so the second time I watched the Ultimate Edition, that I think is hilarious. And I'm actually going to connect this, ready, to Bill Belichick.
Oh.
Here, and we thought we were going to have one.
No, we didn't. We're never going to have one. So if you remember before they rescue the sex slaves, which, by the way, Amazon claims is a reference to Sucker Punch, interestingly, mm-hmm. on their little their enhanced viewer, they say that. Mm-hmm. When the cops are watching a game on TV, do you remember what they're watching? They're watching the Metropolis versus Gotham football game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you remember what happens in the game?
It was a touchdown. They got in a fight, right?
Right, but it wasn't just a touchdown. It was Metropolis was already winning by like 50 something points, and everyone expected them to kneel the ball. But rather than kneel the ball, they threw the touchdown. So then the Gotham people got upset that Metropolis was running up the ball on them. This is what I like to call running up the score on them. This is what I like to call the FUTD. Metropolis went for the FUTD, which Bill Belichick does, just to prove that they can score. They keep scoring because they're not going to take it easy on them. They see that as more of an insult. But just like in reality, Gotham saw that as interpersonal hostility. They saw that, the scoring of the touchdown, as more disrespectful than Metropolis taking easy on them. And that metaphorically, that image encapsulates Batman versus Superman.
I didn't notice any of that. That's hilarious.
Like I said, it took me the second time through the Ultimate Edition to watch that.
That's amazing.
It's amazing that even something that small Snyder does. It represents the theme.
Yeah.
What did you guys see, image-wise?
That montage, montage in the middle of the film, you know, when they have all those overlapping conversations, you know, from the different news media, the different shots, particularly when he's at the Day of the Dead festival celebration, and everybody has their arms out towards him, you know, trying to like reach out and touch him, or the scene where he's floating over the houses that are being washed away in the floods, those are very striking images. You know, because as he's doing these things, the juxtaposition between what he's doing and what people are saying about him and the different accusations that are being made about him and the apprehension of him, it was really striking and very powerful.
Similarly, the painting, Lex's father's painting, mm-hmm. comes up several times of heaven and hell. And Lex even has a quote about demons. We know now that demons don't come from hell below, but from above.
And did you notice at the end of that movie that painting is flipped?
Yes, yeah. The painting is flipped. I think the painting is very symbolic, and the sentiment around the painting is symbolic for
yep.
what Lex sees it as his personal theme, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he definitely does. And it also, it's awesome how it's flipped at the end, and it symbolizes Justice League. It symbolizes Darkseid and an Apocalypse coming at the end, because they're going to come from the sky. So Lex is actually right in a way at the end.
Indeed. That's going to be awesome. Darkseid's such a badass. Bad guy.
So do you guys want to talk about the characters now?
I do, because they're my favorite part of this movie.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with what I call the everyman, and then we're going to move on to the men of ability. And we're going to sort of build based upon importance. So the first one I want to talk about with the everyman is Wallace Keith. Wallace is the Wayne Industries employee who loses his legs and then becomes the fake suicide bomber. Lex uses him as a pawn to blow up the Capitol. And Wallace really represents hatred of the good. And he represents victimhood.
Definitely represents victimhood. I can be convinced that he represents hatred of the good. I'm not entirely sure he does. I think he's your everyman victim. So I'm not sure your everyman victim hates the good. They just feel victimized by something in general.
Okay, I agree with that. You've convinced me. I misspoke. I apologize.
There's an obvious parallel to real life here in that what happens a lot in real life is you have ability to get something done. In this case, dealing with great evil, Superman fighting God. And the fallout from that whole conflict ends up hurting, you know, this guy, this poor guy who loses his legs.
Well, and the little girl became an orphan too. right? That whole scene of Bruce Wayne, the orphan, hugging the girl who was the orphan, looking up at the orphan saving the earth.
Right. Right. So, you know, there's, you know, this guy's a victim, and the manipulative people in the world, aka Lex Luthor, aka, you know, Barack Obama, or you know, Jesse Jackson, these types, then convince them that that they're Blacks. Suffering. Blacks, basically, yes. All the, you know, those people, those bad people, the manipulators, the politicians,
I'd like to point out that the two black characters in Batman versus Superman are on Superman's side.
Yes. Yeah, okay. It has nothing to do with the actual black, okay? Basically, longest point ever, but basically, it is you know, these bad people who use altruism to cash in their own power convince the victims that their victimhood is caused by not by the villains but by the heroes, and this allows them to gain a, you know, a moral license to trash heroes, basically.
Yeah,
and that happens in real life. It's exactly the same thing.
It and the foil to Wally, I keep calling him Wally.
They called him Wally in the movie.
The foil to Wally is the character that doesn't even appear in the theatrical version. The character I referenced earlier, the African character, who initially is convinced to use her victimhood against the hero, but then actually has a conscience about it, and then she dies anyway.
Great point. I didn't even pick that up.
Yeah, she is the foil to the Wally character. Wally's character is...
I'm just picturing a little robot being mad at Superman.
Wally. Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, in the theatrical version, his character is, to me, very different than his character in the Ultimate Edition.
Yeah.
Because in the theatrical version, the way it's edited, it's very up for grabs whether or not he knows that he is a suicide bomber.
Yeah.
And we even had that debate, I think, after the initial viewing.
Yes.
And then in the Ultimate Edition, it's very clear, I think, that he does not know.
Well, yeah, because Lois goes to his apartment and is like, he didn't know he was going to die. Why would he buy milk if he knew he was going to die?
All these groceries in the fridge.
Yeah.
And that the wheelchair was lined with lead, and that's why Superman couldn't.
So take note, terrorists out there. If you want to convince the U.S. government you're not a terrorist, just always buy milk.
Yes. So, but that changes his character from being sort of maliciously violent to being another victim of the Lex Luthor plot of the mastermind of the Tui type character. Not that he wasn't, you know, bad because he was blaming Superman. He doesn't get to avoid that even in the theatrical version, but in the theatrical version, he seems like a psychopathic terrorist instead of someone who's being a pawn.
Right.
Yeah, he's just a pawn, just like all the people who, you know, they end up, being convinced, like, oh, yeah, it's not the disease that killed you, it was the pharmaceutical companies.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And it's also clear in the Ultimate Edition that he didn't know the bomb was in there because nobody knew the bomb was in there. Because even Superman couldn't see it because it was lined with lead.
The lead.
I skipped over the scene in my rewatching. Had Lois figured out that there was going to be a bombing?
No.
No.
Okay. Nobody knew. It was a complete shock. That's why it was such a big deal.
And it played so well. It was a very good shock as a movie viewer, as someone in the audience. It really catches you off guard. But they build up that tension so well. You know, in poor Mercy, you know, Luther's assistant, she looks at the seat next to her and sees that he's not there. And when you watch that movie again and you know what's coming, man, you just hate Luther all over again.
And that's one of the things I love about the movie is the fact that he sends her in there. He literally has no mercy.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That's intentional.
A little on the nose there, Snyder.
All right, well, let's talk about somebody else who died in that bombing, and that's Senator Fitch. And Elliot already hit on what I wanted to say, and he brilliantly pointed out the quote, "Does he act by our will or his own?" To me, Senator Fitch represents collectivism and the idea that another critique of Superman is that he's not allowed to act individualistically. You're not allowed to use your abilities individualistically. You need the permission of the collective. And she has two other quotes that represent this. She says, "To have an individual engage in these state-level interventions should give us all pause." So the idea that the state has more legitimacy to act rather than the individual. And then, "How do we determine what's good? In a democracy, good is a conversation, not a unilateral decision." And James, doesn't that fly in the face of objectivism? Isn't that like, well, you could only have written that if you were an objectivist?
Yeah, exactly. It flies in the face of just anyone who believes there's a such thing as truth at all. Because she's drawing this false dichotomy of like, oh, truth, you either believe that truth is a unilateral decision or that it's a conversation. Well, no, truth is the fucking truth. It's just the way things fucking are. And it's up to each of us to decide what it is. But at the end of the day, what people think has nothing to do with the truth. There's the truth, and then there's our interpretation of each individual's interpretation of the truth.
Right, what you're saying is up to us to decide what we believe is true, not decide what is true.
Yeah, right, but she's literally, in order to confuse the issue, she makes it about not fact, but about what we think are the facts. And it's like, if truth is a matter of just what people think, then it sounds a little bit better if you make it, you know, if you make the truth a democracy and not a dictatorship. But that has nothing to do with what the truth actually is. So it ends up just proving her collectivistic point.
And she really, I mean, because when she's talking about those state-level interventions, and you now when you see the Ultimate Edition and you see what she's specifically referring to, which, as Justin mentioned before, was that drone about to bomb that village.
Yeah, it's so fucking ironic.
It's beyond ironic. Like, you really realize what a villainous woman she is. She's literally trying to obfuscate the truth, and she wants to convince people that there is no really objective truth independent of people's perceptions or people's of consciousness, because she's trying to cover up her involvement and the state's involvement and what they tried to do to that village.
Yeah, it's not about killing the people. It's the fact that Superman can't legitimately kill the people. So it's a very Goodell move.
Oh, goodness. But this will be a continuing theme. Just from my experience with DC, this theme is not going away, and it may be a major part, because this is just going to make the governmental characters now more adamant that there needs to be some safeguard against the powers of Superman or the Justice League.
And we've learned that it's a psychopathic clown and a black guy who shoots really well.
Yes, indeed. although that's just the start. I mean, the stuff they do in the comics or in the cartoons or whatever is even more sadistic and twisted. Mm-hmm. So Senator Finch, I think, is a wonderful introduction to a theme that I look forward to playing out further in future movies.
All right, let's talk about the last sort of set of Everyman characters that I think is really important to the theme of the movie, and that's the Kents. We see both of them in this movie. Pa Kent is sort of like a vision or a, you know, meditation on Clark's part. He goes up to the top of a mountain and he thinks of what his dad would say to him. But his dad and his mom both sort of do the same thing where they give him the motivation. And the thing that's really interesting to me is, as wrong as Pa Kent is, as we talked about in Man of Steel, about what motivates other people, he really has an interesting thing about what motivates himself. And it's his own values and his own romantic relationships. You know, Superman asks him, Clark asks him, you know, how did you stop from hearing the voices of the people who died at the Lang farm when you pushed the flooding onto them? And he said, it wasn't until I met your mother, and she basically became my world, that I was able to live with my decisions and know that I was doing the right thing.
Yeah, is this psychologically not only the stuff that Clark is dealing with in this movie, but remember that he is still dealing with the aftermath of having killed the last remaining person of his species. So there's some similarity here where I think Clark is dealing with his own screams in his head, for instance.
That's true. I mean, that's a good point I hadn't thought of, that we think about this movie as being Batman's psychological trauma, but Clark has his own psychological trauma he's coping with.
Do they really get into that in the actual content of the movie, though, or is that only explained in the extended cut?
It's not very well thought out even in the extended cut. It's just, if we take this as the DC universe, or the extent, what is it, the extended universe, the DCEU,
yeah.
Then we know that this film takes place not all that long after this has happened. With
18 months after Zod.
Right.
Yeah.
To be the bad guy here a little bit, I don't know if we should be reading in contexts that aren't explicitly in the films themselves, even if they could plausibly be in the films at some point.
Well, Zod's dead body is in the movie. I mean, it's clearly an event that's still there.
Yeah, it's an event that's still there, but do we know that Superman feels bad about it? Personally, I wouldn't care if he's the last member of my species. If he's the last member of my species, he can die all the same. The species is better off without him. The species is better off with just me.
I think it's not explicit, but I think it's important that we have to take that context into account.
I can't point to how
Superman feels about it, though. He could feel the way, I would expect him to feel the way Daniel does, but, you know, it's not explicated.
It's sort of, to me, at least implicit in Clark's conversations with his dad and his mom about his place in the world. And then especially the conversation with his dad, his real dad, in the previous movie.
And let's not forget that in the previous movie, it was about him deciding whether to pick Krypton or Earth, whether he wanted to be Kryptonian or human, and he decided to be human. And now this one, he's learning that this is his world, and he has to accept that this is his world.
And to be really clear, I'm not saying that this is a major theme. I was just saying it's interesting, an interesting parallel. Pa with, you know, meeting Martha, and that's helping him with his psychological trauma, and Clark and his choosing of Lois.
And I think it's an important statement on the role of the relationship between men and women and what women provide psychologically to men.
Yeah.
Most men.
He's not talking about sex, Elliot. He's talking about things that even you would appreciate about women.
Let me ask you this then, Elliot, since you brought that up. How are you, in the Ultimate Edition, there's a scene where he calls his mom just to hear her voice and just says hi, and she says, Clark, is there anything wrong? And he just says hi, and she says hi. When that happens to me, like, that really, like, gets me every time I see that, because I think that's deeply revealing of the mother-son relationship.
So there's one scene, I knew there was something that kind of hinted at it, which is why I thought about it on the rewatch. So Superman talking to Lois, Superman says, all this time I've been living my life the way my father saw it, righting wrongs for a ghost, thinking I'm here to do good. Superman was never real, just a dream from a farmer from Kansas. Then Lois replies, that farmer's dream is all some people have. It's all that gives them hope. And she touches the S on his chest, says, this means something. And Superman replies, it did on my world. My world doesn't exist anymore. So that's a counter to, that's sort of like the low point for him psychologically, I think. But I think
That's not the complete low point. He's getting there, but continue.
All right. That's sort of what I think hinted to me in the rewatching, that he was dealing with this trauma.
Well, I agree. I think that's the concretization of everything you were just talking about.
Yeah.
So where he's doubting that he made the right choice.
Not a super explicit, well-integrated theme, and I don't think it has to be valuable, but just something I found interesting.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on now to the men of ability. And we're going to build up here. I want to start with Wonder Woman. Because
our first man of ability is Wonder Woman.
I'm not using man in the gendered sense. Stop triggering me, Daniel. Trigger.
You trigger?
I'm just gonna yell. I'm going to
trigger, please.
Oh, that's good. I really like that. I'm just gonna go to the Wonder Woman movie and yell triggered every 30 seconds.
Oh my god.
Make sure you wear your Triggly Puff shirt.
Oh my god, Triggly Puff.
So I think Wonder Woman is really important to look at here, because this is how they integrated in the Justice League. And also her journey, which I expect to make more sense after seeing the Wonder Woman movie, but her journey in the movie is itself a mini echo of Clark's journey, where she says, 100 years ago, I gave up on the world because of all the tragedy. You know, she fought through World War I, right? So 100 years ago was 1916. So after World War I, she gives up on the world because of all the tragedy she's seen. But she sees everything that's happening now and decides it's worth fighting for.
Yeah.
For me, it would have been the other way around. But
what do you mean?
Actually, I'm just trying to be glib. But yeah, World War I was pretty.
Gotcha.
Does anyone have anything else to say about Wonder Woman?
The main criticism of Wonder Woman is something that I found wildly bizarre. Wildly bizarre. Which is that the main criticism of Wonder Woman is that she was tacked on at the end.
Well, right. That's why I was just saying her whole journey echoes Superman's.
It couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
She's integrated throughout the movie in multiple ways, multiple situations. She has one of the more romantic in terms of decision-making scenes in the film where she has to decide whether or not she's going to rejoin the world.
Yeah, that scene on Turkish Airlines where they're like, Miss Prince, and she just walks away defiantly is fucking awesome.
Yes.
That's like it. You, without Wonder Woman, the theme would not be anywhere near as concretized as it was.
Yeah.
She plays a big part in that film. So I just wanted to tell everyone else to go fuck themselves, all the critics, so that she was tacked on nonsense.
Which especially matters when we talk about the role of men and women and the way she basically, in a way, saves Batman and Superman. I mean, Batman would have been dead from Doomsday's laser vision if she didn't show up with her bracelets.
That's true.
Funny to say, but yeah.
All right, so next Men of Ability is also a woman, Lois Lane. And Lois Lane is really important to this movie because we have all these characters who are trying to attack the good. But she's the one who's worshiping the good, who's loving the good. And we actually see her conflict. I mean, we see this at the beginning where they're in the, you know, bathtub scene, and she feels responsible for the deaths in Africa because, you know, she realizes later when she's talking to General, whatever his name is, Sonwicky. I don't know, Christina Red's boss. And they say, you know, she's like, how would they know Superman would show up in Africa to frame him? And then she realizes it's herself. And that's the guilt she's been dealing with the whole movie. And when she says to him in the bathtub scene, I just don't know if it's possible. And he says, what's possible? For you to love me and be you. And of course, this is resolved when Superman is like, you know, you're my world. He's essentially saying, it's the same thing. I can't be you without loving you, which is true, right? You can't be yourself without living in line with your values.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's a very touching moment as well. The bathroom scene is a very intimate moment. Bathtub scene is a very intimate moment. This isn't Orange is the New Black. It's a very intimate moment without being a sex scene moment.
Yeah.
Like Snyder would typically stop and then slow-mo shots of his back. And yeah, anyway. Which I'm sure Ellie would have appreciated.
I just love that.
Can't we all appreciate that, really?
Ben Affleck in the back. Shower, buddy. Ben Affleck in that shower. Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, James, you missed out on Affleck ass.
Yeah, Affleck, you missed out on.
Affleck, yeah, very good.
It was a thing of beauty.
What else do you want to say about Lois and her whole time using her investigative powers? That's why I call her a man of ability. She uses her investigative powers to make sure the good is seen as the good.
Mm-hmm. She, just in terms of her role in the plot and in the Ultimate Edition, she really strings it all together. She is
right.
The one that ties it all the way through, that she is the pull thread that makes sure that the whole plot is sewn together by the end. And without her, and in fact, the stuff that was cut from her in the theatrical edition, it's disjointed and it seems more like the movie is stapled together as opposed to sewn together.
Yeah. And she's Luther's true opponent in a lot of ways, because while he's hiding and creating obfuscation and lies and this whole gossamer web of mistrust and secrecy. She's looking for the truth, and she's looking to expose the truth, and she's piecing it together little by little by little. So it's almost a chess match between the two of them in a way. Every time Lex does a move, she counters. And that's why she's so important to this film.
Very well said. Very well put, Elliot and Daniel. I think you guys nailed it 100%. So let's talk about her opponent. Let's talk about Lex. Lex is really interesting because I think that they've really nailed psychologically how someone comes to hate the good. So we have a lot about Lex is obsessed with his father. Yeah. And it seems like his father was abusive towards him. And he has this distrust of power, and he needs to be the most powerful so he can feel safe. Otherwise, he doesn't feel safe anymore. I mean, one of the quotes that really keyed me into that was when he said his father waved flowers at tyrants. That's kind of him saying, like, you can't try to reason with men who have power. You can only attack them. And then I think a quote that's really important about Lex is when he says the bittersweet pain among men is having knowledge with no power, because that is paradoxical. And that just speaks volumes to his character, how he conceptualizes power and why he hates Superman, because he's the one who thinks he has all the knowledge, but here's Superman without the knowledge he has, who has power. And then a symbolic quote that I really want to point out, when he first sees Wallace and gives Wallace the wheelchair, Wallace says, "Who the hell are you?" And he says, "Just a man." And that really speaks to Lex Luthor's concept of what is possible and what being a man is.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think part of the hatred here is that I think Lex thinks that without Superman, there would be no one to stop him. Like, that he would be invincible, basically, because of his knowledge, because of how smart he is. But it's this is the person standing in his way.
I don't find that to be his motivation. I think it's pretty much pure hatred of the good, because you'll notice that Lex doesn't stand to really gain anything specifically from Superman's destruction. He's thrown in the slammer at the end, and he's fine with that. That's just what he knew would end up being the consequences of his actions, but he still has a sort of psycho satisfaction in what happens at the end.
I think he's okay with the jail, though, because he has the knowledge of Darkseid at that point. I think his context has changed. I do think he believes that when he kills God and people see that Superman isn't a god and he's not all-powerful, or either he's either not all-powerful because he dies, or he's not all-good because he kills Batman. And when he thinks when the world sees that, no one's going to be mad about him, and they're not going to hold him accountable. But when Superman beats him in that way, and Batman, you know, they come together and beat him, he loses in a way that he truly didn't expect. I do agree with you, though, that ultimately it is hatred of the good. They're just showing where that hatred of the good comes from because of his relationship with his father.
Well, he also operates on a bit of an equivocation, right? When he talks about power. Power can't be innocent. You know, when he has that speech at the fundraiser,
yes,
he's operating on the idea of power as force over other people.
Yes,
and what?
Well, that echoes the warlord, right?
Right. That power or principle, which is funny because when he says that, I'm like, well, you're kind of articulating a principle there, so I don't know. But the idea that power has to mean power over others, that's what Luthor is operating on, and what makes Superman powerful. It's not just his ability, but the fact that it's his power over himself, mastery over what he can do, and his contribution to, if he wants to help someone, it's under his own power. There's no force against anyone else. So Luther is operating on a very malformed concept of what power is. He says power can't be innocent, you know, power without knowledge. Like, well, it depends on the power. Because if you're talking about power from within, power over yourself, through your reason, through your application of your mind to your life, then, you know, that type of power is a good power because it doesn't require forcing anybody else to do anything that, you know, against their will. And Luther, he doesn't grasp that distinction. And that, I think, is what fuels his hatred of the good.
Right. And because, that comes from his relationship with his father, where his father treated him in that way.
Right.
Yeah. And James, to clarify something that Justin said earlier, in the theatrical version, or I'm sorry, in the Ultimate Edition, there is a scene where we actually see Luther communicating with Darkseid's like general.
I think yeah, Steppenwolf, who's going to be the villain of the next movie.
Steppenwolf.
So like Luther, the magic
carpet people?
Yes, like the magic carpet people. He's going on first contact with Zefram Cochrane.
Yes, absolutely. So Luther knows that Darkseid is coming by the end of the movie.
Ah.
Yeah.
So that's where he derives, you know, being okay with being in prison.
Right, that's why he thinks he's won, because he has more knowledge, right? Because remember, when he goes to the Kryptonian vessel and he takes control, she says, do you want, you know, we have this database that knows all about these worlds, and he's like, yes, teach me. Because he thinks if he gets more knowledge, it will make him more powerful. He gets the knowledge of Apocalypse and Steppenwolf coming and the mother boxes, and then he thinks he's more powerful again. So he, and by the end of the movie, Lex Luthor believes that the battle of the movie is irrelevant, basically.
Mm.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting how that plays out, but
yeah. So let's move on to our title fight here. Let's start with Batman. And the interesting thing about Batman in this movie is it's largely his arc, right? The movie, it starts with him and ends with him. And he's a villain in this movie. I don't know if many people realize that, but he's trying to kill Superman. This is Batman v. Superman. This is like a legal battle. Batman is the claimant and Superman is the defendant. And he believes that Superman needs to die. And this is because of the psychological trauma he suffered of not only his parents dying, but everything he's gone through in Gotham, you know, where he says to Alfred, how many men have stayed good? And then the other thing that I think is interesting that visually concretizes this is everything associated with Batman, especially in the beginning of the movie, is him falling or going downwards.
Right.
You know, it opens with him falling into the Batcave as a child.
Yeah. No, I didn't notice that that visual imagery, but that's cool. Batman's character to me in this it was hard for me to wrap my head around in the beginning, primarily because I have the thing that James was talking about where it's like, I don't blame the good guy for the bad things that happen. I blame the bad guy. So like coming from that psychological space was very difficult for me. I think watching the Ultimate Edition, it was better because it sort of, it eases into it more than the theatrical version. I don't know. Did anyone else have an issue with this? Like, it was hard for me to empathize with Batman. And maybe I wasn't supposed to. I don't know.
Well, I don't think we're, honestly, I think as objectivists, I don't think we're the target audience to empathize with Batman. I think we empathize too much with Superman. I know I do. In this movie, I feel emotionally about Superman's journey, not about Batman's journey. I feel bad for Batman, and I want him to get over it. And when he does, I feel triumphant at the end when he says men are still good. But I don't identify with him in the movie.
But I think Batman's key is that he's kind of the journeyman. You know, Superman is the ideal. Luther is the man in the shadows. Batman's arc, I think, is the one that's going to, and it's designed this way to propel us into the Justice League movies. He's the one that has to take the journey. So. He may start out as a villain, but I think that through the fight, and yes, through the Martha moment, and through realizing who Superman is, that he and being able to ally with him so that he can take on Doomsday and eventually come out triumphant on the other side, I think that he's supposed to be I'm trying to remember what the term is in Save the Cat. What's that term? I want to say journeyman, but I don't think that's it. But he's the guy I think that that the audience is intended to follow.
Oh, certainly.
His arc, yeah.
I agree with everything you just said, but he's definitely supposed to represent the audience, and he's supposed to represent the average man in society. I'm just arguing us personally, based on our perspective, and you know what we love about Snyder already, and being objectivists. I just don't think we represent the average man that Batman's supposed to represent. Do you understand what I'm saying?
We know, Yeah, we know what to look for, though, because we know Snyder films. So we know what to look for when we watch them.
Right, but we already worship the ideal, and we already treat the ideal as it deserves. Whereas in this movie, Batman's learning to treat the ideal as it deserves. This movie, in a sense, is supposed to be a lesson to the audience, which is why I think some people find it dark and off-putting, because they don't want to be taught a lesson when they're watching a movie.
Yeah. Maybe. That's a good point.
All right, we'll touch on that a little more when we talk about the resolution, when I ask the question, has justice dawned, and if so, how? But finally, the last character we have to talk about is Superman. We already sort of talked about his conflict a lot when we talked about his parents, when we talked about the whole thing with Lois and the, you know, my world doesn't exist here. But his whole question he's basically dealing with is, why fight if he's just going to be attacked for it? He almost takes other people's reactions to his actions as what he should get from it. It's almost second-handed in a way. It's like he's almost dealing with second-handedness in a way. And to me, Daniel, this is where I disagree with you about the darkest moment for him in the movie. The darkest moment in the movie is when right before he fights Batman, he tells Lois he's going to go fight him. And he says to her, "No one stays good in this world." He has lost he himself, when he says that, has lost his faith in the ideal. He feels like Lex Luthor has beaten him.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Dark Knight of the Soul. That's what it is.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with that.
But it's interesting because he echoes when he sees, what's her name? Kadani, the young lady, the African lady's name. When he sees her on TV and she asks, who decides who lives or dies? How can Superman decide? And that picks up later when he's in the staff meeting in the newsroom, where he talks about Batman deciding who lives and who dies. And then it comes up again when he's speaking with the widow of the man that was killed in prison for having the Batman brand, the Bat brand on there. So that's his arc. Like, who decides who lives and dies? Who makes that decision? And I think that that's part of what propels his arc.
Right. It's the response. Like, he's aware he has that responsibility. And he's aware that with this ability, he has to make that decision. But, I mean, it's sort of like a quarterback who knows he has to decide who to throw to, but is unsure he has the right to make that decision. If you have the ability, you have to have that confidence. I mean, if you're a quarterback and you don't want to take the responsibility, you're just going to get sacked the whole time. And it's the same thing with Superman. We don't realize the psychological effect it has on someone when you tell him over and over again he doesn't have the right to make that decision, and he's the one who has the ability. Ultimately, if he believes that, he's just going to stop saving people.
Yeah.
And then the other thing with Superman I think we have to talk about is the Jesus imagery. This continued the inversion of the Man of Steel. We talked about the inversion of the Jesus myth. This continued it with in here as well, down to the fact of him dying. All of it is very Jesus.
Well, it's an image system. Well, it's an image system. Even at the end, when Lois is holding his body, you know, and the camera's panning away, very reminiscent of like old paintings of Mary holding Jesus' body after being removed from the cross. You know.
Yeah, I actually want to get that and just put it up on my wall as a painting. You're talking about when Batman and Wonder Woman are standing there and Lois is holding the body. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, and it's evocative of that.
Yeah. Well, and also when Batman in the fight is carrying Superman on his back, it's almost like the signs of the cross, carrying the cross.
Yeah.
Anyone else have anything to say about this, or do we want to move on to the resolution?
I think a lot's been said on it already.
Okay. Yep. So then the resolution, we have three things we have to hit here. We have to hit the Martha scene, we have to hit This Is My World, and then we have to hit the funeral and Bruce Wayne's discussion with Diana Prince. So the first thing is the Martha scene. In the climax of the battle between Batman and Superman, Batman is about to kill Superman. He's proven that the God can bleed by cutting his cheek in the same way that Leonidas cut Xerxes' cheek. Did anyone else catch that parallel?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very intentional on Snyder's part. And as he's about to kill, Batman's about to kill Superman, he has his boot on the throat of Superman. And Superman's comment is not, you know, save me, to let me live. It's you're letting him kill Martha. And from Superman's perspective, this is interesting that it shows that he's so value focused, that it's not about his own life, that he realizes the most important thing is his own life is to, when his own life is at risk, to save what he values the most, which at this moment is his mother is in the most danger. And then from Batman's perspective, this has a very jarring response. It triggers him, and this is what a lot of people have a problem with. He says, say, you know, you're letting him kill Martha, which this makes Batman think of when his mother died, Martha, and in the way it was shot, they emphasize his dad, Thomas, saying Martha as she's dying. Batman then freaks out and says, what did you say? And he says, save Martha. And then Batman has a series of PTSD flashbacks. Lois Lane runs in, and she's like, why did you say
that? Two assholes laughing. Oh, my gosh.
Says, why did you say that name? Batman says, why did you say that name? Why did you say Martha? And Lois says, well, it's his mother's name. And in that moment, after Batman has just said right before he's going to kill Superman, you were never a god, you were never even a man, Batman realizes that Superman is just a man too. And not only that, he cares so much that rather than worrying about his own life and beg for his own life, he's begging for his mother's life on his deathbed.
Yeah, I sort of get, like, on paper how all this scene works. I like the symbolism. I like the idea that Batman sees him as to use leftist terminology, as an other. At one point, he says, Superman, you're not brave. Men are brave.
Yes.
And so I understand all of that. My problem with the Martha scene is not the symbolism of it or the sentiment of it. It's entirely the execution of it. The execution of it is just not good. And I don't know how you can justify it. Like, the acting is shit. The way it's cut together is goofy. The way that Lois runs in is I don't know what it is. It's just, ugh. And like, they should have reshot it. They should have shot it multiple times. I don't know what it was, because it's so incongruent to me with the rest of the movie and with the rest of what Snyder does. Like, he does intimate moments pretty fucking well compared to other directors. And like, this just does not hit. I watched this now, just this scene, probably 6 or 7 times to see what am I missing. And every time I just cringe because it's just so poorly executed. And that's why it stands out to me, because nothing else is poorly executed.
So, James, did you have something to say?
Rant.
Oh, yeah. So, another bit of imagery that I noticed the second time around was how Superman is being sacrificed on an altar, essentially, when Batman's about to stab him. He's got him set up on some kind of... I forget what the object was, but it looks a lot like he's on an altar about to be sacrificed, like an animal.
Yeah, I mean, it's very Judas killing Jesus.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Right. And Daniel, I have sympathy for what you're saying about the execution. Like, I think the main thing that makes it come across very poor is that he says Martha first right off as if Batman's going to have any idea who Martha is. That's the problem, I think. Like, if he had first said, you're letting him kill her, and then Batman's like, what? You're letting him kill Martha. Save Martha. Then it might have made more sense. But the fact that he comes out right away with, you're letting him kill Martha, is very strange.
This might be one area, too, where I think Snyder underestimated the intelligence of his audience, which is rare for Snyder, where we see basically essentially the same flashback scenes from Batman that we saw earlier. Like, either we didn't need them earlier, or we don't need them now, or we need different scenes now. But I think this, like, hammering that in is one of the rare times that the Snyder is underestimating his audience.
Yeah, Snyder's never done that before. That's one of the filmmaking techniques I hate the most, when they flash back to something earlier in the movie to explain why something later in the movie is in there. It's like, haha, did you see how we set this up? I mean, that's the end of Saw, where they flash back to the villain. No, I'm serious. When the twist at the end of Saw, when he gets up and proves he's been alive the whole time, they flash back to everything throughout the movie. That's what they do. It's like, haha, we got you. And Snyder's never done that before, and I've always hated that technique, movie-making-wise.
So, yeah, like, I don't know. I think you could do this scene and it could be beautiful and heartfelt and I could cry, but it's just, this isn't it.
Oh yeah, I certainly don't cry during this scene. The scene I cry during is when Superman's about to fly to kill Doomsday.
Yeah, that's to me a much more heartfelt and intimate moment. So.
Yeah, to me that's more the climax of the movie. That's why when you said the ending, like, actually there's probably three endings. It's the Martha scene, and then it's the This Is My World scene, and then it's the Bruce and Diana scene. So the This Is My World scene, that gets me. So Lois has gotten the Kryptonian spear, and Superman has it, and Superman has already made the conclusion that Batman said before, that this is what I have to use to kill Doomsday. And he looks, and he's like, he's going to fly into battle, and I don't think he thinks he's going to die, but, you know, it's pretty dangerous. And do this, he has to be deciding to fight and save the world, so he has to have made his decision and come to his overcome his conflict, and he does. And when Lois is like, no, don't do it, don't do it, he looks at her and he says, this is my world, you are my world. And he's finally owned the fact that to fight, or to live up to his values, to be himself, he has to use his abilities to save the world and fight these battles. Otherwise, he's not being true to himself. And that's why it gets me so much, because it's like the perfect way that loving another person and loving yourself aligns.
Yeah. That is, to me, the most beautiful scene in the movie, even though it's sad. I don't know if I thought it was sad the first time I saw it, because I didn't know Superman was going to die. But, like, when he makes that realization and he makes the full-on commitment, he went full Earthling. He went full Earthling.
Went full human, we'll say.
Yes, there you go. That, to me, was applause-worthy. Like, the theater should have erupted with thunderous applause.
Yes, and, you know, it echoes his mom's advice, where his mom said, you know, be their hero or be none of it. You don't owe this world a thing. He finally decided. He didn't do it out of obligation. He didn't do it out of other people. He did it about his own values.
Yes.
But I want to talk about for a second, I'm going to throw this to James, about what you just said, about what happens, you know, how Doomsday kills him. It shades your viewing of that. Because I don't see that moving as sad. I don't see that moment as sad at all, even though I know what happens after. Because I don't think he intended to die. I don't think he was intending to, quote-unquote, sacrifice his life. I just think he's like a soldier going to battle, where he says, what happens, happens, but I need to do this. So what I want to throw to you, James, is a lot of people are saying it's a sacrifice on Superman's part, and that's when he finally becomes Superman, because he finally sacrifices his life. Is it a sacrifice? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no reason to interpret it that way. I think the only reason it gets interpreted that way is because we are so primed to read altruistic motives into a Superman or into any hero whatsoever. And as you pointed out, you know, and we read altruistic motives into that of soldiers all the time. Like, oh, well, they're sacrificing their safety, you know, to go into battle. Like, well, no, they're defending their values. They're every bit as much as it helps you, it helps them to have their country defended. And there's a difference between sacrificing your life and putting it at risk to get something done that needs to be done. And I think it's colored Superman's bravery to recognize reality and realize, if I have to save Martha, if I have to save Lois, my world, I'm going to have to take this risk. And save Martha too, by the way.
Right, you just pointed out an interesting echo. I wasn't even going to mention, but that's a good point.
Right.
Yeah, not a sacrifice. Definitely not a sacrifice. I think he's doing it for his values. He's not doing it despite his values, like we pointed out with Iron Man, who basically is like, yeah, call Pepper, whatever. I
wasn't going to bring that up, but yeah.
Right, and I think on the more negative side of this coin, I think it's worth saying that, you know, even though Lex Luthor is a capitalist, he's a CEO of a major corporation, I think people are going to be reading in a selfish motive into Lex Luthor's actions, when there isn't a selfish motive whatsoever. There's no self to be had in what he does there. he's sent to jail, and he personally doesn't benefit from it. He just gets to assuage his personal insecurities and his hatred of the good.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raised a good point about Lex Luthor. He's defined by his father, and he's defined by Superman. And in a way, I would say it's actually a commentary on millennials in the way that he basically inherited this company, and he hasn't done anything, yet he has this massive inferiority complex because of it.
Yeah.
Nice.
Definitely intentional.
He's like the Kylo Ren of this universe. He's a millennial villain.
There, I had not thought of that, but Lex Luthor is Kylo Ren. You heard it here first. So let's talk about the.
That. Who knows?
To be fair, Hayden Christensen was Kylo Ren before.
Hayden Christensen is hipster Kylo Ren. I was Kylo Ren before he was cool.
That's right. Emo Vader is what Hayden Christensen was. So
let's talk about the final. The final
I
ending to this.
Them. I killed them all. The worst dialogue ever written in anything.
So let's talk about the let's talk about the final climax of this movie, and that's the resolution of Batman's arc, which frames the entire movie. Right at the beginning of the movie, he says there was a time when there were diamond absolutes and all of that. And then at the end, he finally starts to believe in these absolutes again, and that's in the absolute of Superman. And as he watches Lois mourn Superman, he feels a certain responsibility for what happened because he didn't identify Lex Luthor earlier, and he didn't punish Lex Luthor. He bought into what Lex Luthor was saying. He, in his responsibility, he talks to Diana Prince, and he says, you know, men are still good. As we talked about earlier, you know, he finally believes that in the goodness again, because he finally believes in the monument. He finally believes in the symbol of hope. And he says to her, I failed him in life. I won't fail him in death. This both sets up the Justice League, but also finalizes the arc of the movie. The man who represents the audience, the man who represents men, finally believes in the goodness of men, and living up to the ideal, and honoring the ideal, and honoring the men of ability in the way it deserves to be honored.
I like it. That's a very good summary. That's better than I certainly could have put it.
That's how I interpreted the monument. If you seek his monument, look around you. I interpreted that line or that monument as look around at each other, because each of you now, it's on you to reach the ideal that he set.
Right, and now, it scans the crowd.
Yeah, it's the conviction on everybody there and on the audience. It is on you now. But you have to reach up to the ideal. You need to be that symbol of hope in your own life.
Right, that's a great
for
point.
Your own reasons.
That's a great point, because it also, in the movie universe itself, you know, beyond what it's challenging the audience, but in the movie itself, it's saying everybody else finally got the importance of Superman.
Yeah. I'm not sure what else there is to say about that. I mean, I think that's a good summary. I think it nicely sets up the sentiment for why one would want to start the Justice League.
Yes.
Because it's hard for me to think about like an appropriate reason to get together a bunch of superheroes and be in a club. Like, why can't you just all be superheroes? Can't just do that shit? But, like, the sentiment of, like...
When you don't have Sam Jackson, there's no reason to get together.
Well, yeah, it's a not... But that's the thing, is with Sam Jackson, it's easy. With the Avengers, it's easy. It's a governmental organization. Like, yeah, of course, the government handles force. We'll just get these people who are big and powerful and put them together. When it's a non-governmental organization, it's hard to set that up without being trite. But I think this movie does it really well.
All right, so I think that sums up Batman versus Superman. So do you guys want to rate it?
I'll go first, because mine will probably be the most controversial. While this movie is good, I think I have to rate this within the context of Zack Snyder movies. And
so do it 1 out of 10. 1 out of 10. Or 1 through 10.
We're not doing the 3 thing anymore?
Nah, just you. We got rid of that. Do it 1 through 10.
Fine. But... yeah, like, this is a fine movie. It's even at some points an excellent movie, but like I said, some points I just don't. I can't get it. I will never get it, and I will never defend it. So for me, this movie is a good movie that I don't have to rewatch much ever. Versus like if 300 is on, I'll fucking watch 300 any moment I see it, or Watchmen, or even Sucker Punch. I'll pop in all the time to watch.
Interesting.
So this is a very soft 8 for me. A very soft, squishy, malleable 8.
All right.
Maybe to make it so I like. More so, my sentiment is it's more like a 7.9 repeating.
So this is why it's more fun to do 1 through 10, as you pointed out. So James, go ahead. What do you rate this movie?
I rate this movie a 7. On my scale is that an average is a 5, though. So that may be pretty much the same as Daniel. I like the themes, especially the first time I would have given it a 6. That I watched it the second time, I could see the potential it does actually have. And I feel like I did understand it more thoroughly the second time. And on that basis, yeah, a 7 for it. It has certain themes in it, and it underdevelops them. But I think if they're fully developed, as I'll probably see in the special edition, then it makes good on that promise of being a 7 out of 10, which in my book is pretty damn good.
And we'll allow you to change that rating once you watch the Ultimate Edition.
Right. It won't be locked in. I won't be fully committed to that. You won't say, nope, too late. You said it was a 7.
All right, Elliot.
I'd actually give it a 9. And the reason why is because, you know me, I'm an ooey-gooey romanticist, and I just loved the exploration of the theme. It worked so well for me because I didn't just see it as Superman, a story about Superman as the ideal man. And I, like I said before, I really took it as an indictment on the audience and prodding the viewer, you know, to question their view of the good and the capacity of man to be a heroic being, you know. And for me, that's really what pushes it over the edge, because I really like that it gives the audience that choice and really kind of prompts you for a response. And I do think that that's probably why it got such a negative reaction from so many people. They didn't like that they were being pressed with, you know, to kind of identify their own views of the capacity for heroism. So, I mean, I give it a 9.
Everything everyone has said is very well taken. I think what Elliot said is very true about why the audience responded, I think, on a subconscious level to the movie the way they did. I also think Daniel's critiques of the Martha scene are well taken. And because of that, I also give it a 9 out of 10 because of the poor execution of the Martha scene. Otherwise, I think it would have been a damn near perfect movie if the Martha scene had actually been executed the way it was intended. So now let's rank it. And what we do is, here, James, and we'll let you... maybe we'll have Daniel go first again, or Elliot go first, if you're not ready for this. But we rank all the Snyder movies. So I personally don't remember how I ranked them on the Man of Steel episode. So audience members who are obsessed with continuity, you may notice mine is different, but whatever, tastes change. The way we formulate things in the past change. But what we do essentially, James, is we rank all of his movies. And his movies in order of release are... Dawn of the Dead remake, 300, Legends of the Guardians of Ga'Hoole, Sucker Punch, Watchmen, I think that's it. No, was Watchmen before Sucker Punch?
Watchmen was before Sucker Punch.
Yeah, Watchmen, Sucker Punch, Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman. So are you ready to rank those, James, or would you like someone else to go first?
I definitely have someone else go first, but I could eventually rank them once I tack it.
Why don't I have Elliot go first here, and then I got mine.
Okay.
Right, I'll put the damn owl movie in the basement. I hated it. Dawn of the Dead after that. Let's see. It's so hard because I'd probably put Sucker Punch on top of that. Then I would put Watchmen, 300, Man of Steel, and then Batman versus Superman at the top. I think
interesting.
My favorite that Snyder's done. Yeah.
Daniel?
So, look who doesn't do show prep now, Mr. Lesneski. I went back and listened to my ratings from the last podcast.
Yeah, I intended to do that, but football was on, okay?
Fucking yelled at me on the last podcast because I changed my ratings on purpose, let alone...
Did you happen to listen to mine, too?
No.
Damn it.
I have a couple things, and then I'll do my ranking, then I have a question for later, and then a fact for later. Just remind me. So, bottom is, of course, the Owl movie. I don't know why the hell he got involved with that. I mean, he did the best he could with such a dumb story.
I saw an interview with him recently where he said he doesn't really see it as a kids movie, and the studio wanted to make him a kids movie. So I think that's why it is what it is.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So at the absolute bottom is the Owl movie, and then Dawn of the Dead. Now, for me, because of my personal sort of not enjoyment of it, even though it's a good film, next comes Batman vs. Superman. And then Man of Steel, same sort of thing. I like most of Man of Steel, but some of it bothered me. But look, the reason those go in the middle is because the three movies on top are just fucking epically good. Like, unbelievably epically good. And it's hard for me to think of anything as being able to surpass them because of the context when they came out and their originality and greatness. So third from the top is Watchmen for me. Only third from the top because of the sense of life. Second from the top is Sucker Punch, which is one of the most underrated movies ever. And then at the top, like holding a fucking glorious staff beating down everyone else is 300. I'm not sure how anything could surpass that. 300 is such an unbelievably good movie, and for the context of history, like, what was that, 2006?
Mm-hmm.
That movie came out. Everything after that was a 300 knockoff. Like, everything. So, yeah, 300 for me is just the pinnacle. So, Owl, Dawn of the Dead, Batman vs. Superman, Man of Steel, Watchmen, Sucker Punch, 300.
All right, James?
Wow. I just realized that I'm the person in this on this show with the lowest crow epistemology.
they're owls, not crows, you asshole.
I have to rank them first to last, personally. 300 is one of my favorite movies, period. That's number one on my Snyder list. Behind that, which inches out Batman Superman only a little bit, is Watchmen, because I just really liked the flavor of having all those superheroes, especially Rorschach. I liked the themes in Watchmen played more to my sense of life, because I personally questioned the need for heroes in my life. I've never really questioned that. It's not a struggle I deal with. Whereas, I think a lot, like a big way to make that a big way that Batman versus Superman makes you think is if you really feel a kinship with Batman, which I didn't. And usually in most of these movies, in most movies and depictions of Batman, I really do. So, Watchmen inches out Batman versus Superman. Behind that, Batman versus Superman, and then Man of Steel. Behind that, all good movies. But yeah, that's the order.
All right, so Daniel, I'll give my order, and then you can do your question and fact. Does that sound good as a way to close out the show?
Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure on that question and fact.
I got it.
All right. So, I'm 100% sure this order is different than the order I did before, but it's fine. So, like everyone else, the Owl movie's at the bottom. Then Dawn of the Dead comes next. And then there is a huge... I want to emphasize this, because it's going to be shocking what I say next. There is a huge chasm between Dawn of the Dead and Snyder's other movies. Like Daniel, I think all... I think all of his movies besides Dawn of the Dead and the Owl movie are epic movies. They're amazing. They're better than everything else that comes out. What, James?
Sorry. I'll say it once you're done.
You forgot the Owl movie?
I forgot Dawn of the Dead, which is my least favorite. Zack Snyder. It's behind Man of Steel is Dawn of the Dead.
Have you even seen the Owl movie?
I haven't seen the Owl movie.
Yeah, that's your least favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize that, and I probably agree. I just haven't seen the movie. And when I did see the previews, I do remember thinking, like, hey, that looks cool. I want to see that. I like this. But that's neither here nor there.
Okay. So are we ready?
Ready.
Okay, so after the huge chasm between Dawn of the Dead, I actually put Batman versus Superman. Then I put Watchmen. Then I put Sucker Punch. And part of the reason I put Sucker Punch so high is the fact that it's an original movie. All of Snyder's other stuff is adaptations. And I think Sucker Punch deserves to be a little higher because of that. And also, the more I think back on Sucker Punch, the more fucking brilliant it becomes. Like, every time I think about it, I just love it more and more. And then right above Sucker Punch is 300. And then, of course, my favorite Zack Snyder movie is Man of Steel. So those are our mid-side rankings of Zack Snyder movies. As he continues to make more movies, we will release them, or we will release our episodes on them. But as for now, we will probably move on to another filmmaker. If you have an idea of who you want it to be, let us know. Midsider Alfred has already requested that we do Christopher Nolan. So you can reach us via Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. Anyway, Instagram, any way you want to reach us to let us know what filmmaker we should cover next, we value your input. So to close out the show, Daniel, what is your question and your fact?
Yeah, so I'll do the fact first, which is, the Snyder series is now coming to a close, at least until Snyder's next movie, Justice League, when we will reopen the vault. So by the way, if you want to listen to those, you can go to themidside.com/podcast and just search for Snyder series and they will come up and you can hear our analysis of all of Snyder's movies, even the godforsaken Owl movie. But I want to say that the fact that I looked up, I wanted to see how many people listened to our last Snyder series on Man of Steel, and just between us and SoundCloud, so I don't know what liberty.me's download numbers are, between us and SoundCloud, over 600 people listen to the Man of Steel.
Well, SoundCloud is the Liberty.me feed.
Yeah, but SoundCloud requires you to upload a file. So it's not drawing from the same feed.
Right, Liberty.me does it through SoundCloud, though. You're saying there's a different SoundCloud?
No. Liberty.me also does it through iTunes.
Oh, okay. So I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So I don't know what their iTunes download is. So it's well over 600 people are interested in Man of Steel. And I think there's more than that. I think there are more people out there who are interested in Zack Snyder and who are sort of closet Snyder lovers. and we need to reach them. So if you know someone who likes Zack Snyder, like if you go up to him and ask him, like, are you a friend of Zack? And they shake their head.
That's like, a really geeky Hollywood reference, if anyone's wondering.
Indeed. Like, turn them on to the podcast. Turn them on to the Snyder series. We need to band together as Zack Snyder fans, and not let the trolls win.
Hail Snyder!
Godforsaken trolls win. I wear my Hail Snyder shirt out in D.C. like at least once a week, and I'm inundated by dozens of people who are like, I fucking love that shirt. I love Zack Snyder.
Oh, yeah.
But they say it in like more like hushed like tones, like, hey, come here. Hey, you want to buy this watch? And then I'm like, no. Then they say, I love Zack Snyder. So.
Oh, in that case, I'll buy the watch.
Yeah.
Because I am a watch man.
Man?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so dumb. We will stoop. There's no level to which we will not stoop for a joke. My question is simply for Justin, shilling aside, Facebook.com, Midside, Patreon.com, such as Midside, we won't do that much shilling on this episode. On the last podcast, you did say, I have extremely high hopes for Batman vs. Superman, because we were talking about where it might fit in the ranking on the last podcast. Did this movie meet or exceed your expectations for Batman vs. Superman?
I would say it exceeded them. It's just that he has a high bar with all his other movies.
Yeah. Elliot, James, do you have any thoughts? Because I also had high hopes for this movie.
It exceeded my expectations. I'm really looking forward to see where he's going to go. And I think any avenue where Zack Snyder can continue to do his work and put it out there for more people to see and to discover, And the more discussions that can happen about his work and about his aesthetic and his sense of life is a good thing ultimately. So I'm just looking forward to see where he's going to go in the future.
Yeah, in that regard, I don't want to bring this podcast down, but I'm terrified of Justice League because of all the political DC stuff that's happened. But I don't want to talk about that and bring down this celebration.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right, well,
on that note.
Yeah.
All right, are we ready to sign off?
Let's go.
Let's do it. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and look for his monument all around you.
Have a day.
Okay, we're good. I'm gonna
get
out.
Three,
now.
Like one excited, one ennui.
He's not Christina Ren.
And one with a sense of longing.
Yeah. Some ennui.
The funny part is that's actually what he said to Christina Ren, and she did it. All right, I'm gonna stop the recording.